As I'm sure you're all aware, there is in Judaism 613 mitzvot, 613 commandments. I know that's an overwhelming number for many, but no one individual is obligated in all 613 unless you'd be male and female, single, married and divorced, Kohen, Levi, Yisrael all simultaneously. I'm sure there are entire congregations in California like this, but for the vast majority of us, we're not obligated in all 613. Nevertheless, the question is, what's the purpose of so many of them? Why are there so many? And to some people, Judaism seems to be obsessed with minor... This is whistling a little bit. It seems to be obsessed with minor hair-splitting details, and it seems to be, instead of religiosity, what a psychologist would call religiosus. Right, and the question is, what's the purpose of all these commandments? That's the first question. Second question I would like to answer is, what's the mechanism? How do the commandments achieve that purpose? Let me start with a story Talmud tells. Turnus Rufus was a Roman who used to often debate the rabbis. Turnus Rufus came to Rabbi Akiva with the following question. He figured, there's no way Rabbi Akiva can answer this question. Whatever Rabbi Akiva says, I will be able to get him, one way or the other. I think I mentioned this story once before. And the story is that Turnus Rufus comes to Rabbi Akiva and he asks him, what's better, the deeds of God or the deeds of man? He figures, if Rabbi Akiva says the deeds of God are superior to those of man, I'm then going to ask him, how can you change anything in the world? How do you have the chutzpah to do circumcision? How can you change wheat into bread? How can you do anything in the world? It's chutzpah, it's unbelievable. And if he tells me that the deeds of man are superior to those of God, I'm then going to ask him, how come you say that? You're a heretic. How do you say that humans superior to God? So Turnus Rufus is totally confident here. He struts over to Rabbi Akiva with supreme confidence, and he says to him, hey, Rabbi Akiva. I don't know if he had an Italian accent. Did the Romans have Italian accents? Always bothered me, but okay. Right, so he goes up to Rabbi Akiva and says, hey, Rabbi Akiva, what's the better? The deeds of a God or the deeds of a man? Right? Are the deeds of God better or the deeds of man better? Rabbi Akiva, instead of answering, goes to the fridge. And he says, just a second, mate. And he comes back with a stalk of wheat and a three-layer chocolate mousse cake with the sasha torret, with the slight raspberry flavour and the moist chocolate cake in it. And then the layer of white chocolate mousse cream, dark chocolate mousse cream, and the mocha chocolate mousse cream with some shaved chocolate on top and some maraschino cherries, dulce de leche, sprinkling of nutmeg. So, anyway, Rabbi Akiva goes over to him and he says, you tell me what's better. Deeds of God, waves around the stalk of wheat. Deeds of man, waves around the chocolate mousse cake. So obviously, what is Turnus Rufus forced to say? The deeds of man are better than those of God. The wheat is not edible as it is. You can't just take a stalk of wheat and eat it, right? So you cannot do that. So what was Rabbi Akiva trying to teach us? He was trying to teach us the following. He was teaching us that the human is like wheat. Wheat in its form that God created is not perfect. It needs to be refined and changed and perfected and turned into something better. He says the human being is not perfect. The world is not perfect. God did not create the best of all possible worlds, as Dr. Pangloss says in Candide by Voltaire. He did not create the best of all possible worlds. He created the world designed to be made into the best of all possible worlds, but it's not there yet. Because the human needs refinement. Refinement in three, and but just by the way, if you're wondering, this is how wheat gets into bread. It's an incredible process. I mean, you have to whack the stalk, and you have to take off the seeds, and it has to be crushed, and it has to be winnowed and threshed, and you have to sift it, and you have to mix it with it. The whole word is unbelievable. Like, you ever wonder who invented it? 5,000 years ago, there's some caveman fag walking along in this field of wheat, and he's walking along, and he sees the wheat, and he says, wow, unbelievable. I bet if you take this wheat, and you cut it down, whack it with a stick 50 times, take the seeds, crush them, turn them into dust, chuck it into some water, turn it into mud, right, let it rot for a little bit, chuck it into the fire, it should taste fantastic. And it does. Right, so it's an amazing thing. But you see, that's what the human being is about. The human needs refinement, and the Maharal says in three major areas. Three areas that we need refinement. I know you're looking at each other and saying, what, only three? But three major areas that the human needs refinement. Number one, awareness of others. Number two, awareness of self. Number three, awareness of God. What I mean by that is the following. Awareness of others is when a child is very young, an infant, they're not really aware of anyone else. They know that you're there, but they're not aware of your needs. They don't care about your needs. They're not aware of what you want or anything like that. They wake up in the middle of the night, right, and say, all they want is food. Feed. I mean, there are adults like this as well, but mostly, right, most adults are not like that, right? The child is not really aware of anyone else. He's only aware of his own needs. My son, Rafi, who's 3 years old, occasionally wakes up in the middle of the night. He says, Abba! Right, my wife trained him to say that. It means dad. Right, so I go there, I stumble over, and he says, I'd like a drink. Only two types of people wake up in the middle of the night thirsty. Young children and alcoholics. So he wakes up, 3 in the morning, he wants a drink. I was like, fine. So I get him a glass of water. Rafi takes a drink of water which is so small it can only be measured by scientific instruments. I mean, that's it. So I said, unbelievable. Now, you see, because at that age, Rafi is not mature enough, he's not aware enough of what I need to take that into consideration. He doesn't think to himself, oh, Dad's tired. I didn't do without the milliliter of water for the next 2 hours. Now, he doesn't think in those terms. As he matures, as most people mature, they naturally become more aware of other people's needs. I mean, some people never get there, right? They're called New Jersey drivers, right? But most people do get there, to be aware of other people's needs. Obviously, if my 18-year-old son would wake up in the middle of the night, Abba, so what do you want? He says, I'm thirsty. I would tell him, get the beer yourself. Leave me alone, man. Right? See, because at that age, he's already should understand. So the first area of refinement is the awareness of others. Second area is awareness of self, meaning to become aware that the self is not just the mouth and the stomach and whatever nerve ending it happens to be. Right? That's not what the self is. The self is more than that. So, for example, the child, Rafi, doesn't wake up in the middle of the night saying, Abba! I say, yes. He says, why are we here? He doesn't say that. What's the meaning of life? No. That takes at least until they're 8 years old in my house. Right? But in general, right, the human being has to understand that the self is not merely the physical. Fulfillment of my physical needs is not enough to satiate the soul, satiate a human being. So awareness of self is the second component of refinement. And the third is awareness of God. To become aware that I have a need to make contact with God, with Hashem, with the Creator. That's a real human need. If it's not fulfilled, then people get frustrated. There are a whole bunch of negative things that happen if the soul does not have that opportunity to have contact with God. And so therefore, the first idea is the commandments are there to refine humanity, to make us aware of others, to make us aware of our complete self, and to make us aware of God. That's number one. Number two, Sifra, it's one of the Mishnah, which says it's following. A person should not say, I should give you some background here, as you probably know, the Torah prohibits veal parmesan, cheeseburgers, and pepperoni pizza. It's not explicit in the Torah, but more or less, right? You cannot have meat and milk together. So now, the Mishnah says the following. A person should not say, I can't stand meat and milk. It should not say that. You should say, you know what? Looks good. Tastes good. I don't know if it tastes good, but it looks good, right? And I would like it, but I choose not to do it. What's the meaning here? So I understood the meaning of this, and I read to my children for the first time one of the great classics of English literature. They probably study it in college here in the States. It is called Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss. Anyone read that? No. So we're living in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem. I read to my kids, Green Eggs and Ham. The first question my kids ask is, what is ham? They never ask what green eggs are. Never. Now, the reason for that is either one of two things. Either some bizarre component of child psychology, right, that green eggs are normal to them, right, you never know with kids, right, or it's because of the school cafeteria, right, they think that's what eggs are meant to look like, they're green. If they see a white egg, they'd say, hey, what happened to the egg? Right, in any case. So, they ask me, what is ham? I tell them, ham is the meat of a pig. What is their reaction at that point? Ooh! I say, it's not ooh. It's not ooh. They say, we don't eat it. I say, we do eat broccoli. They say, good point. Right? So I tell them the idea, you see, I don't want to educate them to believe that it tastes disgusting because it doesn't. I don't want to educate them to believe that it's unhealthy because it's not. I point out to them, look, there are approximately 2 billion Chinese. Major part of the diet in China is pork. Do the Chinese look like they're in danger of extinction any moment? Like, they get just like that, one extra ounce of pork, goodbye! Right, it's not going to happen. Right. So obviously, I point out to them, you see, I don't do it because Hashem, God said not to. In other words, what am I exercising here when I refuse to eat it? If it's just a matter of, if I believe it's disgusting, horrible, tastes terrible, and that's why I don't eat it, is that really free will?
No.
It's not really, it's just because, I mean, I don't walk around eating garbage from the ground either. Right, that's not the rule. Look at this amazing free will he's got. He didn't eat that piece of chewed gum on the bottom of the chair. That's not free will. You know, this doesn't take much self control. What the Torah wants to do is to exercise the power of self-control, of free will. That's a muscle which is often not exercised. People think they have choices. Choice does not mean the guy sitting on the couch with pizza and beer, right, and a remote control with 150 channels of cable. This is not exercising free will. You don't look at the person and say, look at the majesty of the human being, the greatness of man, the power of free will, the soul. No. You see, free will is more than that, self-control. And that is a second component of what the Torah wants to teach us, which is to exercise the power of free will. Number three is that a central component of the Torah is the idea that the purpose of the human being is to have a relationship with God in the world to come. After the body ceases to exist, the soul still exists, and the soul has a relationship with God. And the soul enjoys that relationship. There's a tremendous pleasure in that. Because if you could imagine everything you love, everything you honor, everything you respect, everything you want, everything you desire, all rolled into one, that would be a fraction of what it means to have a relationship with God. But you see, in order to really have the pleasure and the joy of a relationship with God requires that there be compatibility. Any relationship, if it is to be deep, if it is to be enjoyable and pleasurable, has to have more than merely superficial compatibility. There's got to be a deepness of compatibility. Example, in New Jersey a while ago, actually in New York, New Jersey, a while ago, a couple of years ago, Coca-Cola had a competition that if you remove the bottle, the cap from the bottle, there was a code underneath it. And if you got the winning code, you would win the first prize. I had someone at my house, actually. We had a bottle of Coke. They opened it up and it said, try again. So they closed it. Needless to say, this person was not a PhD candidate. Okay. Anyway, so if you got first... Now, this time, many years ago, if you got first prize, you could win 1 week touring with the Backstreet Boys. This is a rock group, probably never heard of them. Right, anyway, so I think the last survivor is Justin Timberlake, whatever. Anyway, so you get 1 week, is that right? I don't know. Anyway, you get 1 week touring with the Backstreet Boys, and you get to serve them drinks backstage. Is that unbelievable? I mean, okay, to some people this might be a first prize. Now, I remember at the time that the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra was playing in New Jersey. The Berlin Philharmonic was conducted by Herbert von Karajan, the great German conductor. Amazing stuff. I have a series of 7 CDs of Beethoven by the Berlin Philharmonic, Herbert von Karajan. It's unbelievable. I drove to Pittsburgh 2 weeks ago and back, and it was the middle of the night in the country, in the country of Pennsylvania. I had Beethoven blasting at the maximum on my CD. There were truck drivers swerving as they went past me. It was great. Anyway, so Herbert von Karajan, right, was conducting the Berlin Philharmonic. And I imagined to myself, imagine what happens. He's finished the concert, he goes backstage, and he gets a Coke from the machine. Herbert von Karajan. Gets a Coke. He opens the cap. He looks at it. He says, "Aha, I found." Let me ask you something. Do you think that a week with the Backstreet Boys would be first prize for Herbert von Karajan? Or would it be condemnation to the depths of hell? The answer is B. Right. Yeah, you see why? For a very simple reason. Right? There is no compatibility. For one thing, he's human, whatever, but I mean there's no compatibility here. Right? So in order for us to have the joy of a pleasure of relationship with God requires that we have compatibility. A third idea in the mitzvot, the commandments, is to create to that compatibility and similarity with God, with the Creator. That's number three. Number four, I picked up in Santa Barbara. I was at the University of California in Santa Barbara. I was teaching, and schmoozing with the students beforehand, which is always fun, because especially in California, the type of courses that people actually can take in college are beyond imagination. Someone told me they were taking a course, it's called Empowerment of Women with Eating Disorders Through Native American Song and Dance. This is a college course. For this, they pay $30,000 a year. In any case, so I asked this fellow, this guy really laid back Californian, and he was almost horizontal on the chair, right? And I asked him, so what are you majoring in? He said, like, I said, go ahead. He said, like something between religion and philosophy. I said, between religion and philosophy. He says, yeah. I said, could you be more specific? He says, sure. I said, well, go ahead. Right? And he said, I'm majoring in revelation. Revelation. In his case, I think it was part of a chemistry course. But you see, what does it mean to major in revelation? I do not know. But in any case, I thought to myself, I went to a Hasidic high school, and the founder of the Hasidic movement, the Baal Shem Tov, used to always say, not when I was in high school, he was, you know, he was in the 1700s, but okay. But he used to say, they used to tell us that he said, they claimed that he said, whatever. Anyway, that anything that you hear or see or happens to you is there for you to learn from. And if you don't learn from it, you've wasted the opportunity. So I said to myself, if the Baal Shem Tov was sitting with me here in Santa Barbara, hard to imagine, but let's say, right, what would he have learned from this student? And I said to myself, of course, it's explicitly in the Zohar. The Zohar says the following, that every single one of us is majoring in revelation. We are supposed to be majoring in revelation studies. What does it mean, revelation? That it is our purpose to reveal the true nature of the human and the true nature of the world. To reveal godliness in the world and in the human being. If I act in a selfish, mean, egotistical manner, then, you know what I've done? I've concealed the image of God within the human being. Someone looks at me and they say, there goes a fairly advanced ape. But if I act in a manner which is altruistic and kind and just, then what I've done is I've revealed that there, someone looks at me and says, there goes the image of God. The neshama, the soul. You can either act in such a way that a person sees the soul, or you can act in such a way that a person sees the only the body. You can act in such a way the world that the person sees only the material, or we can act in such a way that the person sees the spiritual as well. And that is what the human being is balanced between. We're balanced between, I mean, you could take a person like Jesse Ventura. Have you heard of Jesse Ventura? He's a famous American politician. He was the governor of the state of Minnesota, former wrestler and former Green Beret. His nickname is Jesse the Body Ventura. It is not Jesse the Psych Ventura, Jesse the Soul Ventura, Jesse the Mind Ventura. There's a very good reason for that. Right? It's not that. It's Jesse the Body Ventura. Because when you see him and when you speak to him, all you are aware of is the body. That's it. Right? See, so, but you see, a human being could act in a different way, and then you could be aware that there's a soul as well. That's a very important aspect of the human being. And so the fourth aspect of the commandments is the recognition or the revelation that there is a God in the world and there is a God, there is the soul within. And finally, there is the idea that every mitzvah is like a piece of art. It's like a sculpture. A piece of art, what it does is it takes a concept and it brings it down into a physical form, so that you can look at it and grasp the concept easier. So if you would see, let's say, anyone seen The Thinker by Rodin? Famous sculpture? This guy sitting there like, thinking? The Thinker? Right, so you look at that, and he took the concept thought, and he put it into a sculpture. Anyone, you may have seen Salvador Dali's picture, Nausea. Anyone seen that?
Yeah.
Right, so what do you think of when you see it? Nausea. Right, basically, that is what art does, and that's also what the mitzvot do. The mitzvot are things that take incredibly high concepts, and they bring them into physical forms. If I wanted to show that the house is a place where God can dwell, if I want to show the concept that God has cares about each individual, each family, each person, if I wanted to show that God is aware of what happens in each family, each home, each house, if I want to show that the house can be as holy as a synagogue, if I want to show that the presence of God and the love of God is in this house, how would I show that? The answer is, I have a mezuzah on the door. That's one of the ideas of the mezuzah. The mezuzah takes all those ideas and squeezes them, crams them, condenses them into this little package, right? And you put it on the door, and that's what really what it says. That's what all the mitzvot do. So those are the five ideas behind the commandments. Number one, refinement, awareness of self, awareness of others, awareness of God. Number two is free will and decision-making versus autopilot and non-decision-making. Number three is imitation of God so that I can have a relationship with God, so I will not be like Herbert von Karajan at a fish concert, right? So, and number four is to reveal godliness in the self and in the world. Number five, to encapsulate ideas in physical, simple physical formats. Now, how did the commandments get me there? How do they get me to that point? How is it that if I don't eat lobster, somehow it gets me to these ideas? It's a very strange thing. So let me start, first of all, with an idea. It's a metaphor. In other words, we believe, it's not really a matter of belief, in any system of morals, in order to be a moral person within that system, you've got to have two basic components. You've got to be committed to the ideas, and you also must be consistent with those ideas. You must act consistently. So is that clear? For instance, it is possible to be consistent without being committed to something. Is that possible? Could you act consistently with some principles without really believing in them? Yeah, you could. For example, if you lived in Singapore, right, and Singapore is very clean, totally clean, the traffic flows smoothly, no one jaywalks, no one runs red lights, there is no graffiti. No one speeds. You know why? Very simple. If you jaywalk or litter in Singapore, you get an on-the-spot $500 fine or you go to jail immediately. If you do graffiti, you get whipped publicly. If you litter, you get on-the-spot $500 fine or you go to jail. Commercial vehicles, taxis, etc., have lights on the roof. The lights attach to the speedometer. If they go over the speed limit, the light starts flashing. Police pick them up, give them a ticket. They were going to do that in New York, New Jersey, but they figured the whole place looked like a disco if they did that. Flashing lights all over the place. You wouldn't see anything but flashing lights. So in any case, now, someone in Singapore might be acting consistently with good ideals. He's clean and he's neat and he drives well and he's safe, etc. Because he believes in it? Does he believe in it? I don't know. But you just can't get away with it. So we're not actually sure. So in other words, you could be consistent without being committed. Could you be committed and not consistent? Could you believe in certain ideals and not act consistently with them? Very, very common. That's what most people's problem is. That they believe in certain ideas, but we're not committed, we're not consistent with them. For example, the principal phones home from school. He says, "Mr. Smith, your son is going to be sent home from school." So, of course, every parent, that's the worst thing you could want, right? I mean, it's not a punishment for the kid, but the parent, this is like, right? He said, "What do you mean? My son sent home from school?" He said, "Why? Why?" So the principal says he was caught cheating in an exam. The father says, "My son? The saint? The genius? Even," music starts in the background, "even if my son Johnny needed to cheat, he wouldn't because he's so good. And he's so brilliant, he never needs to cheat. So I'm going to be calling my lawyer with the other phone unless you have some evidence." So the principal says, "We have evidence." He says, "What's the evidence?" He says, "The boy sitting next to your son Johnny and your son had exactly the same answers in their final exam. Exactly the same." What is the father going to say? "My son, the boy sitting next to the son of Satan sitting next to my son Johnny, he cheated from my son. Not my son, throw the other kid out of school." He says, "I have further evidence." He says, "What's the evidence?" He says, "Question number 19, the boy sitting next to your son wrote, 'I don't know.' Question number 19, your son Johnny wrote, 'I don't know either.'" So it would appear to me that neither is Johnny so brilliant, nor is he so pious. So Johnny gets sent home from school. Johnny's sent home from school. The father subjects Johnny to one of the worst punishments known to the adolescent mind. A parental lecture. A long one. He says, "Get into the study." The kid says, "Not the study, no. The torture chamber, please. The rack. Anything but the study." "The study." He says, "Okay." He goes into the study. He says, "Turn off your MP3 player." "Okay." "Turn off your BlackBerry." "Good." "Turn off the cell phone." "Okay, good. No cameras." "Okay, fine." The kid's unwired. He gets into his listening mode. You know, and the father takes out one of the lectures which parents have in filing cabinets. A, adulthood, B, C, cars, D, drugs, dating. Honesty. He takes out the honesty lecture. And he starts giving the big talk about honesty and integrity and truth. And the kid is like, you know, right? And he's like, honesty and truth and integrity, blah, blah. And the phone rings. And Mrs. Smith answers the phone. She says, hello? And says, oh, Mr. Goldberg, how are you? And the father says, just a second, son. He says, I'm not home. In the middle of the honesty lecture. I'm not home. And she says, I'm sorry, Mr. Goldberg, he's not home. Oh, on the cell phone? Father says, just a second, son. Shh. She says, oh, I'm sorry, yes, he's on a business trip. Business trip, yes. Oh, the satellite phone. She says, oh, yes, he's in Tierra del Fuego. Yes, it's the southernmost tip of Argentina. No, no, I'm afraid there's no satellite service. Yes, okay, goodbye, click. And he carries on with the honesty lecture. Does Mr. Smith believe that honesty is a good thing?
Yes.
I think
yes.
He does.
Yes.
Does he believe that truth is good?
Yes.
I believe he does. But he's not consistent. This is also, obviously, it's not great for the kid's education. I mean, you can imagine. The same kid, the principal phones home. He says, Mr. Smith, this time it might be a police matter. You've got to come to school right now. I don't even want to talk about it on the phone. Smith says, what? What? He says, come to school. So he comes to school. His son's sitting there in the principal's office. And the principal says, he says, what is it? The principal says, your son has been stealing office supplies from the school for the past year. Father says, is this true? The kid says, and he says, I don't understand. You need office supplies? Ask me, I'll get them from work. So obviously, this type of thing is not great for a child's education, no question. But what it does illustrate is that humans, one of our great problems is we do believe in many things. We are committed to many ideals. But even though we're committed to these ideals, we're not necessarily consistent. Right? And let me give you an example. How easy is it to be consistent with an ideal? Now, if you think it's easy, it's not really easy. I'll give you an example. I'm going to take one principle. One principle. I don't believe in this principle. We're going to take one principle, though, and we'll see how easy is it to be consistent with one principle. The principle, let's pretend that as of tomorrow morning, I've decided that my main principle in life will be animals should not suffer for the sake of humans. Therefore, I will not benefit from the suffering of an animal. That sounds pretty easy, right? Sounds pretty easy? Let's go through the day. Let's start. You wake up in the morning. What's the first decision you have to make relevant to that issue? First decision you have to make relevant to that principle as soon as you wake up. Before you think about clothing. Before clothing. What? No, relevant to toothpaste, soap. Do you use cosmetics? Do you know what happens in the Colgate plant in Pennsylvania? Do you have any idea? Rabbits strapped to a lab bench somewhere in Pennsylvania at the Colgate plant. A diabolical machine doing this. How long will it take the rabbits to die of an overdose of Colgate? Standard procedure. I don't know if they actually do this, but they do similar things with cosmetic plants. You know, they put aftershave in the rabbit's eyes and that type of stuff. You know, they actually do this type of stuff. So, should you use the Colgate toothpaste or not? What do you say? Do you use Colgate? Should you use it? If you believe in this principle, should you use Colgate? Of course not. So you don't brush your teeth. No cosmetics. So you smell a bit, and your mouth is upholstered, right? Right. And then what's the next decision you have to make is? Clothing. Do you wear leather?
No.
Do you think the animal gave it voluntarily? Here, take my coat. I don't know. No! Right? So, therefore, no leather. So you have no belt, you're holding up your pants. Right? You have uncomfortable shoes on because you can't wear leather. Right? Now, what about wool? I mean, sheep's also not volunteers, you know what I mean? The sheep's walking along, bleh, bleh, bleat. Right? And then some Australian guy grabs and he says, come here, mate. And he goes, and bingo, he's naked, right? And now you've got a sweater, right? So that's not very nice for the sheep. So no wool, no leather, no natural fibre. So you're wearing like these uncomfortable clothing, you're holding up your pants, you can't walk too well, and your mouth is like, and you smell a bit, right? So now you're not in a good mood. Any human that you confront is going to be in danger. Animals will be safe, right? Because that's our principle. Now, what's the next decision you have to make? Breakfast? What are you going to eat? So you decide, you have to forget, I'm going to skip breakfast today. It's too complex. I can't think about this at this moment. So for lunch, I go to a restaurant, and I say to the waiter, g'day. And the waiter says, g'day, mate. I'm your waiter for tonight. Name's Bruce. And I say, look, Bruce, what's good for lunch today? He says, oh, the steak is awesome, mate. So the steak's great. I said, look at him, and I say, excuse me, but I don't believe that humans should benefit from the suffering of an animal. I do not want your charred cow carcass. Right? No steak for me. Right? I don't believe animals should suffer for me. So Bruce looks at me and says, no, you don't understand. He whips a little piece of paper out of his pocket and he says, he reads from it. He says, all the meat in our restaurant comes from the Happy Valley Ranch. So the Happy Valley Ranch, is that right? In the Happy Valley Ranch, all the cows are allowed to wander wherever they want. There are no fences, no barbed wire, no electric barriers. These cows eat any type of herb and grass that they want, both legal and otherwise. They drink only spring water and Foster's lager, and they get a shiatsu massage every day. These cows are the luckiest creatures on earth. They're happy, they're content. Every now and again, one of them dies. And so we cut it up and make steak out of it. So this steak is kosher for vegetarians. Would you eat, let's say he's telling the truth, would you eat the steak?
No.
Why not? Did the animal suffer?
No.
The animal had a life that most humans in the world would want. Ask any human. Most of humanity ask, would you like to be a cow in this ranch? They say, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But you'll be eaten after you die. It's a big deal. Right. So you know what? So the truth of the matter is, of course the cow wasn't given that choice, you might argue, but you know what? To me, it's a decision you have to make. I decide, not this is awesome. So I asked for a few kilo of the steak. I said, let's take it home. Because I thought I have to be a vegetarian, God forbid. And now I can eat steak as long as it's from Happy Valley Ranch. So what I do is, I invite some friends over, put some mesquite wood in the barbecue, put the steak in some Murray Vale wine, some garlic and some cloves, stuff like that, and let it marinate a little bit, chuck it on the barbie. Right, I've got the Foster's Lager in the fridge, I've got the skimmer on in the swimming pool, I've invited some people, beautiful day in Bondi Beach. Right, and I'm poking around the steak on the barbecue, which Martha Stewart says she shouldn't do, but of course she's in jail, who cares. Right, but again, I'm poking it around, and then I think to myself, hold on, what is my neighbour going to think? Is that important? Is it a moral issue what my neighbour is going to think? What do you think? Well, think carefully, because if my principle is that no one should benefit from the suffering of an animal, is it going to help me if my neighbour thinks I'm a hypocrite?
No.
It's not going to help the principle. So, and let's say I convince the neighbour. I say, Bob, look at the joy oozing out of that steak. It's from Happy Valley Ranch. Even if I convince him, what about a stranger walks by on the street and smells it? What's he going to want to do? Eat steak? So therefore, I have to make a decision. So I decide, you know what? I shouldn't have this steak, even though it's from a happy cow. So now I go to the dairy section of the supermarket. I figure I'll get some dairy stuff. Okay, what could be wrong with dairy foods? So standing next to me is an animal rights activist. I know that, because he's got a PETA t-shirt, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and he's got a look in his eyes, which is what is called by doctors mononeuronic syndrome. How many neurons do most people have in the brain?
Billions.
Billions. But there are people who have only one neuron. They're called mononeuronic. That one neuron is focused on one issue. No jokes may be made about the issue. No conversation may deviate from that issue. And it creates a certain look in your eyes called mononeuronic. Anyway, so the guy standing next to me, he's definitely mononeurotic. Anyway, he looks at me and he says, you like dairy foods, huh? So I want to ingratiate myself. I say, no, but I don't eat meat because I don't believe that animals should suffer for humans. And he says, he points the accusing finger and he says, and what do you think? Cows are not suffering to give you that milk? I said, of course not. If you don't milk a cow, it's in terrible pain, isn't it? Right? He says, what about cows in the wild? I said, cows in the wild? You ever heard of a cow in the wild? A wild cow? A wild cow escaped from a cow, you know, escaped from an Iowa ranch today and, you know, killed three people. I mean, that's it. Right? Poodles. No such thing as wild poodles either, right? Right? You never hear about hikers in southern France being attacked by wild poodles. Not that it would worry me, but you never hear it. Right? So anyway, so he said, what about cows in the wild? So I said, cows in the wild. He said, I'll tell you what happens. You see, when the cow has a baby, it produces milk. When the baby cow nurses from the mother gives milk. When it stops nursing, the mother stops giving milk. End of story. He says, do you know why you have all this ice cream and yogurt and dairy foods and stuff like that? I said, no. He says, because the baby cow is over there in the veal section of the freezer. Has he got a point? Does he have a point? So you figure, okay, no dairy food. So you go to the health food section, where everything is brown and green, right? And there's tofu, and there's fermented tofu, and there's rancid tofu, and there's rotten tofu. The type of diet, you don't actually live longer, but it feels like you're living much longer. So anyway, you go to this place, and you look at a power bar, and you think of the power bar. What could be in the power bar? You cannot fit a cow in a power bar, right? But on the other hand, you look at the ingredients, it's got glycerides, that's from animal fat, and it's got gelatin, which is from animal bones. And it's got natural red food flake colouring, which is from cochineal beetle extract. Now, it doesn't say animal stuff in here, because according to the FDA, if it's less than 2%, that doesn't have to say animal content. And then you think to yourself, hey, what's 2% between friends? Do you think 2% is significant? Yes. I mean, if it was 2% of you in the power bar, would it bother you? Yeah, oh heck. Right? So now, what's 2%? So you have to make a decision about that. Now, I'm going to end the analogy. You know what I'm pointing out here? Do you understand what the metaphor is for? If you want to be consistent with the principle, you know what you have to do? You really have to work things out. You have to think about every single detail. You can't just say, yeah, I believe in that principle. Don't bother me with details, because then you're not really consistent, are you? Right? If you think that it's a detail what happens to the cow, that's not a detail. It's a very important part of the principle. And so the truth is that, you know, the Talmud and Jewish law is the ultimate guide to consistency. We want to be consistent. We've got these ten principles here. To be consistent with those 10 principles, you know what you have to have? 613 commandments. And to be consistent with the 613 commandments, you know what you have to have? An entire Talmud, all of Jewish law. For millions of people, in thousands, over thousands of years, in hundreds of countries, to live consistently with these principles requires an entire system that is worked out. The system of Jewish law is exactly that. It's the ultimate guide to consistency. That's point number one. Point number two is, we believe that actions affect the inner person. Actions affect the inner person. If you want to be a giver, how would you go about it? Let's say, as of tomorrow, I would like to be generous. Right now, I'm a stingy creep. I'd like to be generous as of tomorrow. So I decide, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to read the biography of Albert Schweitzer. I'm going to read the biography of Maria Theresa. I'm going to meditate and say, give, 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 give. Right, I'll do this for quite a while. Will that make me a giver? No. You know what will make me a giver? If I give! If I take some money out of my pocket and give it to someone who needs the money. That's what makes me a giver. The action makes the person. And indeed, in so many areas of life, the actions that we learn in the commandments give us the ability to have self. Let's take, for example, kashrut. The dietary laws, kosher laws. Imagine for the moment, and this, I don't know, unless you're a parent, you probably haven't gone through this. One of the worst things you could have is, you're with your 5-year-old at the supermarket right after school, they have not eaten supper yet, and you have to buy some things from the supermarket. So the kid's all like, you know, antsy, he's been in school all day, he wants to like break out and destroy the world, whatever, right? And in addition, he's hungry, and you don't want to ruin his supper, and you are standing there at the supermarket in the 8 items or less aisle. The person in front of you does not use a base 10 system. She has 280 items, okay? And she's trying to pay for them with a third-party check from Guatemala, made out in like Greek drachma, right? She's got coupons from three hostile takeovers ago, before the store became Walmart, whatever it was, right? And you're standing there, and then, not only that, but as it gets to your turn, right, the lady at the checkout, right, the ribbon runs out. And as she's trying to change it, her nose ring gets caught in the mechanism, right, they have to call someone from next door with a staple remover, whatever, you know, and anyway, and in the meantime, your son, your 5-year-old, is surrounded, on one side, by soft porn, and on the other side, by a canyon of chocolate bars. You've got to imagine it from the child's perspective. He's 5 years old, that means the chocolate bars are the size of this. He's standing there like this. Looking at these chocolate bars, and he's hungry. And you're waiting and waiting. And he says, Abba, can I have one of those? And I say, no! And he says, can I have one of those? No, ruin your supper! And he says, can I have one of those? No! And he says, if you don't get me one of those, I will throw myself to the ground. I will kick, scream, and have a hysterical fit. I'll have such a tantrum, you'll become frustrated and upset. You'll eventually hit me. Someone is then going to call the police. There'll be social workers involved. There'll be lawyers. Isn't it cheaper to get me the stupid candy bar for 75 cents, huh? Right, my kids do this all the time. Anyway, so I was once at the supermarket in Canada, Toronto. I was standing there with my five-year-old, who's now 18. And we're in this situation, and he looks up and he says, "Abba." I say, "Yeah." He says, "May I please have one of those candy bars?" I say, "You asked very nicely from Shimon. Let me see, which one would you like?" He points to one. I say, "I look at it, and I look for a kosher supervision sign." And I say, "Sorry, Abba Shimon, it's not kosher." You know what his reaction was? Okay. Anything else? He did not scream. He did not throw himself to the ground. He did not threaten me with a lawsuit. He did not call a social worker on his cell phone. Nothing. It was unbelievable. Right? And you know why? And I thought to myself at the time, looking at the other side of the aisle with all the newspapers and stuff, I thought to myself, it's amazing. My five-year-old, who's been raised with the laws of kashrut, has more self-control than most adults in the Western world. Tell an adult, no. You know what they think that means? They think it means you're dyslexic and you're said right on. Right? So, no is not in there, isn't that not in the vocabulary? When you say, look, no, what they think is, oh, don't get addicted. I mean, no. Oh, I mean, be safe. I mean, no. I mean, don't get caught. No! The idea of no is just not, isn't in the vocabulary. The idea that you should control yourself is not there. Not there. So, one aspect of the laws of the Torah are that the actions affect the inner person. It does do that. They're behavior modification techniques. Shabbat. The Shabbat tells me that there's only so far I will go to advance in my career, to advance economically, to advance in any way. When it comes to Friday afternoon this time, that's it. End of story. So there's a tremendous lesson in each of these. Even the way I dress, the clothing that you wear affects who you are. It affects how others look at you. It affects how I look at myself. I remember when I was in the Israeli army, I used to get called up for reserve duty once a year. I would put on the uniform. I know it's hard to believe. I was not exactly a commando, you know. But I would put on the uniform, right? But as I was putting the uniform on, with the big boots and the khaki and everything and the belt and everything, I could feel my muscles slowly expanding as I transformed into Rabbi Rambo. Once they gave me the gun, I would stand there and say, "Which way is Syria?" But you see, because the uniform doesn't have an impact on you, right? And it also affects how others look at you. A friend of mine, who's a minor actor, he's minor enough, he usually only plays dead people. So he's very good at that. He lies on the table. CSI, he's seen him in CSI a few times, being on autopsies. Anyway, so now, he's Irish Catholic. He was once acting in a movie in which he was dressed as a chassid. It was being filmed somewhere in Brooklyn. And he was a little hungry, and he was sick of the caterer and the movie crew. So he decided that one of his favourite Italian delis is right there. So the chassid walks into the deli. He says, "Give me the ham on rye, please." The guy behind the counter, large crucifix, says, "No." He says, "What do you mean, no? It's a free country. Give me the ham on rye." The guy says, "You want to go to hell? You do it yourself. I'm not going to help you." The guy says, he realises how he's dressed. He says, "Oh." You know what I'm saying? He says, "I'm Catholic like you. I'm an actor in a movie." And he says, "I've heard that before. Get out of my store." So clearly. But everything, in fact, everything we actually do, everything we say, everything we do, the way we dress and everything really affects the inner person. The inner person is made up of the actions that we do. And so Judaism uses those actions to impress upon us certain ideals. In addition, the idea of commandments is to remind us, because without the commandments, we'd forget who we are and why we're here. That's what humans do. Humans tend to forget what they're about. Right? We get into life, right, and all we think about is the next buck, right, and the car and everything, and that's all we think about, and we tend to forget. So why am I here? Why am I doing this? What am I in the world for? We don't think. I had a dog for 13 years. The dog was the most content creature I've ever seen in my life. He was happy to lie on the heating vent or air conditioning vent, depending on the season, for the entire 13 years of his life. Not once did it ever cross his mind why he's alive. My Labrador did not get up and say, "Why are there dogs? Is life just a bone?" He didn't think that way. It didn't bother him. He was never bothered by that. Humans are bothered by that. But we need reminders. So we have things that remind us. Before I eat, I say a blessing. So I know, why am I saying, what am I eating for? I get out of the door and I'm on my way to work, the mezuzah. Why am I working? So on and so forth. Very, very important ideas. And finally, rights versus obligations. That is to say, the mitzvot teach us that a person has to be focused not only on their rights, but you know what you have to be mainly focused on? Obligations. You know, there's a big difference. Psychologically, there's a big difference. Story, the Talmud tells the following story. Alexander of Macedon. You've heard of Alexander? There's a movie about him, so I'm sure you want it right there. So Alexander was conquering. He was not conquering. He was on vacation. He was in North Africa. He meets with this African king. And a court case comes before the king. The case is the following. One guy says, I bought a field from this guy. He says, right. And he says, and as I was ploughing the field, my plough hit something. It's a box. I dig up the box, the jewelry in there. I say, I didn't buy jewelry, I bought a field, the jewelry belongs to him. Alexander's saying, what the heck? Right? I mean, right? Would this ever happen here? You take the jewelry and sue him for damaging the plough. Right? So anyway, then the other guy says, oh no, I wrote in the contract that I'm selling you a field and everything in it. So the jewelry belongs to you. Alexander cannot believe this. He's downing daiquiris one after the other. Can't believe this is going on. So anyway, the African king says, he asks one guy, he says, how old is your oldest unmarried son? The guy says, 21. He says, uh-huh. He asks the other guy, how old is your oldest unmarried daughter? He says, 19. The king says, well, great. By virtue of the power invested in me by me, I hereby declare the children engaged, and the money you found in the field will go to their wedding. And everyone embraces, mazel tov, mazel tov. They're all happy. I don't know about the kids. Parents are happy. That's the main thing, obviously. Right? So anyway, but what happens is, Alexander is absolutely in a state of shock. He cannot believe this case. He cannot believe it. So the African king asks him, he says, suck dog. He says, what, you don't like how I ruled? So Alexander says, he says, look, in my country, this had never happened. Never happened. The guy would take the money and run. He says, no. He says, but if it did happen, how would you have ruled? Alexander says, it would never happen where I live. Never. He says, but if it did, how would you rule? He says, I'll tell you what. He says, it's simple, he says. I would have killed them both and taken the money from my treasury. Like, duh! Right? So at this point, the African king looks at him and he says, does the sun rise every day where you live? And he says, yeah. Does the rain come down where you live? He says, yes. He says, do you have animals there? He says, yeah. He says, ah, now I understand. It must be in the merit of the animals that the rain comes down and the sun goes up. He says, because the humans clearly don't deserve it in Greece. Clearly don't deserve it. It's a beautiful story. And I think what it's telling us is the following. There's two types of legal systems, two types of psychological ways of looking at the world. One is, in the Western world, children of the Greeks, who look at themselves in terms of rights. What are my rights? What is owed to me? What can you do for me? What do you have to do for me? What are my rights? And there's another way of looking at things. This African country is one way, and halacha, Jewish law. It says differently. It says, don't look at what others can do for you. Look at what are my obligations. Unless you have a feeling of obligation, you cannot be moral. Morality comes from a feeling of obligation. That ought, I ought to do, I have to do. And it's interesting. Right, in this African country, one guy's thinking, I found something in the field, it's my obligation to give it back to the rightful owner. The other guy says, I signed a contract, it's my obligation to carry it through. The king is thinking, I'm the king, it's my obligation to make people happy. And in Greece, what are they thinking? And in America, and in Australia, and in England, etc., what are they thinking? It's my right, it's found in my field, it's my right to keep it. I sold it, it's my right to get it back. I'm the king, it's my right to do anything I want. Very, very different. The mitzvot are designed when a person, a Jewish person, becomes an adult. She becomes what? Bat mitzvah. He becomes bar mitzvah. You know what that means? Obligated. It means obligated. That's the essential component of morality, is the feeling of obligation. And that's what the commandments are out to teach us as well. To paraphrase John F. Kennedy, he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. What Judaism is saying is, ask not what others can do for you, ask what you can do for others. And if you think of a marriage in which two people are thinking only of their rights, what should she be doing for me? What should he be doing for me? Disaster. If you think of a marriage where each one is saying, what can I do for him, what can I do for her? That's totally different. That's beautiful. If you think of a country like that, if you think of a village like that, and it does take a village, if you think of a state like that, if you think of a world like that, it's totally different worlds. So one of the ideas of the abundance of mitzvot is to create within us a mindset of, I am obligated, I ought, what can I do? Those are the basic ideas, those are the purposes, the refinement, awareness of others, awareness of self, awareness of God, the exercise of self-control, the muscle of free will, to become similar to God, to have a relationship with God, to reveal godliness in the world and in the self, and to encapsulate ideas in the mitzvot. And there are a few ways we get there. Number one, commitment and consistency. Number two, that the law, the action affecting the inner person. Number three, the commandments as reminders of who we are and why we're here. And number four, the idea of obligation versus rights. That's it for this evening. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. Thank you very much. And I hope to see you December 25th at the Gateway Seminar.